State Player back with you on this early Sunday morning on 720 WGN. While the elevated Chicago Loop is justly famous as a symbol of the city, the fascinating history of its subways is less well known. The city of Chicago broke ground on what would become the initial system of subways during the Great Depression and finished 20 years later. Take a trip underground and see how Chicago's I Will Spirit overcame challenges and persevered to help with the successful building of the subways that moved millions. Building Chicago's subways was a national news story and a matter of considerable civic pride, making it a second city no more. There's a new book out called Building Chicago's Subways, and author and historian David Sadowski joins us live in studio. Good morning, David.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Absolutely. Thanks for coming down. You know, this year, Chicago's first subway opened 75 years ago. But before that, almost 150 years ago, we had the first transportation tunnels underneath the Chicago River.
Yes. Well, the first tunnel of that type was built in London in 1843, and it inspired people in Chicago to do something similar. They started construction in 1865. There were two tunnels that were completed right before the Chicago fire, and it was a good thing that they did, because when the fire broke out, all the wooden bridges burned, the river boiled, and thousands of people would have been trapped and probably would have died if not for the two tunnels that enabled them to escape and go like underneath the river to safety.
Now, we had underground tunnels before, but they were for like, there were wiring and telephone wiring too in the late 1800s, right?
Well, right around the turn of the century, the late 1890s, a company, private enterprise, built a system of tunnels ostensibly for telephone wires. But within a few years, that business model changed, and it turned out that they started using them for freight, mainly to haul coal and ashes to buildings downtown. There were 60 miles of these tunnels. They went under practically every street. And those tunnels are still in place. They flooded in 1992 and caused over $1 billion worth of damage.
But that was 50 years we had those tunnels there, that they were active anyway.
Yeah, they were never very profitable, but actually they did help to build the Chicago subways later, because they were able to use them to haul away the clay. They were hauling it away in those same tunnels.
It was all run by, some of the stuff was operated by the Chicago Tunnel Company. Tell me about this organization.
It never was very profitable. There were a lot of different things they tried to do besides hauling ashes. They were hauling merchandise back and forth to the sub-basements of department stores and warehouses. They hauled everything except passengers.
Yeah.
And they were also selling air. They were selling temperature-controlled air to movie theaters and places like that, because, you know, down in the ground, it's all like one temperature.
Sure.
Kind of, in a way, a primitive form of air conditioning.
Wow, interesting.
If I can ask a question about, I know that the elevated trains, there were many different companies at the beginning that had elevated lines. Some of them would only go to certain sections of town, and at one point the city got them all to agree to start connecting. They all merged into one company. Was there that type of thing happening underground?
No, there was just the one tunnel company, and then it got reorganized a few times because it sort of became insolvent, and then it got bought out by other people. But the elevated companies, there were originally four different companies, and it was an entrepreneur named Charles Yerkes who got them unified downtown into the Loop Elevated in 1897.
Yerkes Observatory? Same guy?
Same guy.
Oh, interesting. Very cool. There was a Chicago Subway Commission launched in 1911. The Loop L cars were pretty overcrowded at that point. They needed another solution for public transportation.
There was no way they were going to build more elevateds downtown, because as soon as they did, people complained about the noise and them being unsightly. And by the 1930s in New York, they were starting to tear down all the elevateds in Manhattan. They said that they were contributing to blight and crime and things of that nature. So the city by then wanted to tear down all of the elevateds. That was their policy. And of course, we know now that it never happened,
right,
because we
yeah.
still need the elevated today. But they
sure.
needed more capacity. And the only way really to do that was to build subways, and the only way they could build subways was really with government money. It wasn't going to be happening with private enterprise, because there was no way anybody could make a profit.
The book has some really terrific photos and some really great maps in there. There's one from 1938 that kind of laid everything out before construction started. But it was 38 that the city and the FDR administration agreed to build the State Street and Dearborn Milwaukee subways, which opened in 43 and 51. But it wasn't without controversy. I mean, they were trying to figure out who was going to pay for it and really how it was going to get done.
Well, in an earlier time, well, over a period of 30 years or more, they were collecting money to build a subway from the profits the city was taking from the streetcar company. So it was the strap hangers on the streetcars who were inevitably ending up paying for that. But in the early 1930s, the city wanted merchants along State Street to pay for most of the cost of the subway. And, of course, there were lawsuits involved, and,
sure,
and that didn't happen. Then the Depression hit. And it was the conservative Democratic mayor of Chicago, Mayor Kelly, and the progressive Republican Secretary of the Interior, Harold Ickes, who got together and made this happen. But Ickes changed the plans the city had, and that's and the changes were all for the good. They were things that he had been involved locally for a long time.
Okay.
With he had been on the subway commission, so he knew his subject, and the changes that were made were definitely for the better, and there, you can see that today, because nobody's saying, well, let's fix the subway.
Sure.
The subway is doing just fine.
Yeah, to go along with your question about the maps, Dave, and I looked in the book, and I'm seeing all the different maps of the underground, the subway, from what it was original, and I think it was before the map that you were talking about. And there are several lines branching out from existing lines that I noticed. One line, the Douglas line, I think, where there's another branch halfway through branching south on that map. And I know that doesn't exist today, but how far back does the original design of the subway system go?
Well, the idea of having a subway along State Street started pretty early at early 1900s, and the idea was to give more capacity to north and south traffic that was already going downtown on the elevated. The idea behind the Milwaukee-Dearborn subway came later, and that was really to straighten out the path that the elevated took, because it didn't take a direct path down Milwaukee Avenue all the way downtown. It just took, it veered south. It kind of like had an L-shaped pattern. And some of these other plans came about because Ickes wanted them, the city, to commit to creating more than just these initial subways. And so they had these maps that had subways going all over the city in every direction possible. But one thing that he did insist on was the construction of what is now the Eisenhower Expressway.
Right, because that did they have to move the line, or did they, was the subway then, or the train line, because they had to build the highway. So how did they design where the highway was going to go to where the train was? They had to clear a lot of land. So how did they figure that out?
Well, what happened was about 2.5 miles of the existing path of the expressway was taken up by the Garfield Park Elevated. And so that was relocated temporarily onto the street, into the south half of Van Buren Street with Third Rail. They fenced it off. Originally, they were talking about doing it with overhead wire, but that didn't happen. They used a third rail, and then the trains coasted across the intersections, and they did not have grade crossings. They stopped at every stoplight for 2.5 miles. But that was the only part of the line that was actually in the direct path of the highway. The other half of it was not.
Right.
It was either to the north or to the south. And then west of Cicero Avenue, that part ran on the ground all the way to first Desplaines Avenue in Forest Park, where it stops today. But they had a branch line that went even further than that. It went to Mannheim and 22nd Street.
Wow.
And if they had kept that, that would have been a really good thing.
We're talking to David Sadowski. The book is called Building Chicago Subways. Looking at some of the pictures of some of these, some of the underground tunnels and so forth, the architecture itself was pretty amazing.
Yes, well, in it was the era of the streamlined modern Art Deco
influence. Yeah, a lot of the Art Deco, yeah.
And you had some of the most well-known Chicago architects working on, say, the design of the above ground station for the subway, the only one that's on that subway at North and Clybourne, that was done by Murphy, who was one of the leading architects of the time, following designs that were already in place on the London Underground.
Hmm. There was the State Street subway. There was also the Dearborn Milwaukee station as well, as you mentioned. Those were the two big ones.
Yes, and then the third project was what they called the West Side Subway, which was the median rapid transit line. They called it a subway because it was below grade level, but it was really, you know, out in the open in the middle of the expressway.
Yeah, definitely. I remember taking that one still, going out back when I wasn't driving. We didn't have the roads.
And we had the elevated train, we had buses, we even had streetcars. There were plenty of options for public transportation, but by the time the early 1950s came around, things started to change a little bit.
Well, what happened was that another commitment that the city made to the Roosevelt administration in 1938 was to unify the streetcar and the L companies, which were privately owned, but they were both in receivership. They were, both had been become bankrupt in the Depression. And so that the construction of the subway actually was sort of like a lever that was used by government to create the Chicago Transit Authority and its municipal takeover of the transit system. And then in 1952, they purchased the assets of the Chicago Motor Coach Company, which was sort of finalize the public transit.
Well, I want to know why, and we were talking about this before I had him in the newsroom.
I know. I saw that, yeah.
What were the reasons why the city finally got rid of the trolley system and the tracks in the middle of the streets?
Yeah, Dave is also the trolley dodger.
Yeah.
You got a blog that you manage on.
And,
right?
And
yeah.
A book.
And a book on the trolleys,
Chicago trolleys.
www.thetrolleydodger.com.
Yeah, so what was the reason why we finally got rid of all those overhead cables and the tracks in the middle of the roads and stuff like that?
There isn't one specific reason, but a major reason why the city ended up getting rid of the streetcars once they took over was that plans that the city had in 1937 to build a couple of streetcar subways on Washington, under Washington and Jackson, that would have gone to where the Grant Park Underground parking garage is now, and they would have had like a giant loop and a terminus there.
Uh-huh.
Those plans Ickes put the kibosh on those plans.
Oh, okay.
And the reasoning was that the planners thought that while that would divert a lot of street traffic underground, it wouldn't divert as much as it would happen by building a rapid transit subway on Milwaukee Avenue, because people would be using that instead of taking a streetcar. And so they had new modern streetcars starting in 1936 called PCC cars, which still operate in some cities today. In fact, just yesterday, another new retro streetcar line in El Paso started using PCC streetcars from 1937
really?
That have been refurbished.
That is so cool.
They were sitting in the desert for many years, and they refurbished them. But because these were very fast cars out in outlying areas of the city, they ran very fast. But once they got downtown, they ran into congestion.
Right.
So because of that congestion, that's one of the main reasons why inevitably they got rid of them. If they had built these subways, it's possible that some of this might have been saved, as it is in other cities. It's San Francisco, Boston, mm-hmm. Newark, and there are other cities where they do run streetcars in the outlying areas on the street, Philadelphia, mm-hmm. and then when they get into the center city, they run in a subway.
David, how did you get into all this?
Well, when I was 3 years old, my dad took me for a ride on a Chicago streetcar, and I sort of fell in love with it ever since. And I watched some of this construction happening because, you know, the construction of the of the Congress Expressway with now the Eisenhower, that was still going on when I was a little kid, and I saw some of these changes going on. I always wondered, how did this, what was this, you know, what was happening? What were these changes that were being made? And I was kind of like, been interested in learning more about it ever since, and I've studied it pretty much my entire life.
I'll tell you one thing that I still miss from the old days, and I'm only 3 years older than you, is the old days of riding the L and riding the subway downtown, then back up north. There were dispensers. Now we have candy machines. Now you have pop machines and everything. And you've got the vending outlets up on where the ticket counters are. But on all of the L stations, after you paid your fare and were waiting for the train, there were little dispensers. You could put like a penny in or a nickel, and you would get little pieces of like Chiclets gum and or
loose.
But they were loose, yeah. Wow. They were loose. And it would have several slots, and then the other machines were the peanuts. And you would be able to put like 5 cents in or a penny, and you'd get a little handful of peanuts. I don't know where those exist. I don't know if those were up in the museum. We were talking about the Illinois Railway Museum.
Yeah.
Which,
is that where a lot of this stuff is, a lot of the artifacts that are still left from the transportation system here?
Well, the Illinois Railway Museum has done a fantastic job of restoring and preserving a lot of this equipment. They have by far the largest collection of Chicago equipment anywhere, and a lot of it has been meticulously restored and operates. Wow. So it's a fantastic thing. But I remember, even in the 1960s, I remember these penny gum machines.
See?
But I thought, yeah. The ones that I remember, they actually had them wrapped in this little piece of paper that you had to unwrap.
Not paper, but a plastic. Like
wood?
A plastic.
Wood.
Not that. Well, wood that has been, you know, processed down to paper. No, he keeps telling me that I'm
just
older.
older, yeah. Not much. Not by much. You show pictures in the book of current stations that still have elements of the original subway still in them. It's pretty cool. It's all over the city.
Yeah, I think it'd be a great thing if it could be possible to have sort of a retro subway station in the downtown area,
yeah.
Kind of in the same way that they've taken the Quincy Wells L station and they made that into retro L station, because you know you had like a very coherent style. This streamlined modern style that was in the Chicago subway. And over time, you know, with all the different changes that have happened ever since, some of this coherence and style has been lost.
I'm going to ask you a trivia question, and you're going to have to help me. Which train stopped at Wrigley Field, the A train or the B train?
Oh, God, I have no idea.
I thought it was an A train, actually.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because back in the day, the Howard Englewood line, which is now the Red Line, used to run, and we talked about this before, A and B trains to help move people along so that it wouldn't take forever to get downtown or wherever you were going. So certain trains stopped at the A stations and some stopped at the B stations. And then on game day, the A train would have the sign on the front saying this train stops at Wrigley Field. And you would have to look for that train. I always got on at the Howard Station, which was the end of the line, except for the Evanston Express line and the Skokie Swift line that would then extend out from that. But, that was what we would have to wait for.
The book is Building Chicago Subways, a really spectacular book, really covering everything in our past, and great maps and photographs in here as well. He's also got a book out on Chicago trolleys, and you also have a blog called The Trolley Dodger, and the website again is?
www.thetrolleydodger.com.
David Sadowski, thanks for joining us this morning and coming in. I appreciate it, pal.
Well, thank you.
All right. Top stories are next on 720 WGN.